All right, so let's get started here. Okay, so welcome back. And just to remind everyone, the last class was actually 2 weeks ago. So we've started talking about distributed snapshots, and then we did a bunch of election algorithms. There was bully, ring, wireless, and so on. Okay, so we are going to just continue from that point on, and we are still on the same chapter. There are still a couple more classes of material to cover. Okay, so today we will talk about distributed synchronization and mutual exclusion, and then start talking about distributed transactions. We probably won't be done with the transactions, but we'll see where we stop there. So before I begin, just wanted to see if people have looked at the project. Any questions? I hope everyone has started on the project. Okay, so if you have questions, some of you have emailed me, so I'm assuming that you know what to do, right? Don't wait until I ask. Just contact either me or Chang. The other thing is I wanted to mention, which I slipped my mind, is we have to schedule a date for the midterm sometime soon. Okay. Usually I have it as an evening exam, and it's usually in the next classroom here on Wednesdays. Is that okay? Wednesdays at not next Wednesday. I'm just asking, generally is it okay to have it on a Wednesday at 6? Does anyone have conflicts? That was the first question. If you have conflicts, I go through the trouble and then I don't want to change it later. You don't have classes hopefully at 6, right? So 2 weeks, April 9th sound okay, or it would be after your project is due, so there won't be anything due. You can work on just the midterm. Then after the midterm, we'll have the third project. Okay, so tentatively put that down. I haven't checked whether the room is available. I just wanted to first verify that this is something that works for everyone. Okay, I will, as soon as I get the room, I will send an email. Okay, are people getting email now or not? Because I sent several emails, nobody received it, so I don't know what happened. The first, I think, 8 mails seems to have just disappeared somewhere. So finally we got the problem fixed. So I will send an email to the class mailing list and put that note up on the web page. Okay, so you can't miss it. Yes.
So about project 2, I have a question.
Oh.
You said that K plus 1 process means a leader election. What's the meaning of K plus 1 or K plus
1? So there are K front end servers.
Yes.
And then there is a database server, which is really a catalog server and order server. So these processes run an election. The clients are not involved in the election.
You mean in project 2, the catalog server and order server will be used?
No, you could, if they are separate processes, then it will be K plus 2, doesn't matter. I mean, all I'm saying is that the front end and the back end processes run an election and choose someone, that's all. If you have two K plus 2 processes, that's okay. Right? Anything else? Okay, so let's get started with the topic for today, which is distributed synchronization. Okay, so the basic problem here is to grant mutually exclusive access to some shared resource to a bunch of processes. Okay, so you know how to do this in the multi-threaded case. Okay, so when you have a single process and multiple threads, and you are trying to access a shared data structure, you have to protect that data structure with a lock. Okay? And then you have to grab a lock before you either read or write to that data structure. Okay? And when you're done with the critical section, you release the lock. Okay? This is well known, I presume. Now, the same problem, how do you do it when these entities are not in a single process? Okay? You have K processes. They could be running on K different machines. And there is a shared object somewhere that they want to access. Maybe it's a shared file, maybe it's something else, doesn't matter. So now, we want to guarantee that only one of these processes gets access to this shared resource at any given time. Okay? So you have to implement the notion of a lock again, and all these processes have to compete for a lock. But the question is, since the processes are now distributed as opposed to centralized within a single process, how do you implement the notion of locking in the distributed case? Okay, that's the problem of distributed synchronization. Okay, so I'm going to talk about two ways to do this. Okay, centralized, actually more than two, there will be four by the time we are done. But they're broadly, they can be classified as either a centralized lock that services a set of distributed processes, or the locking itself is fully distributed. Okay. So first, let's look at what we call centralized mutual exclusion. Okay. So here, what happens is, again, the processes are distributed, but the lock is centralized. Okay. So we assume that processes are numbered. Okay, and then you run leader election to pick one coordinator. Okay, and we know how to do leader election. So let's assume that part of it we know how to do. Okay. So the basic problem now is that, or the basic approach is where each process that needs to enter a critical section first contacts the coordinator. Okay, and say, I want a lock. When the coordinator says, okay, you have the lock, at that point you continue, otherwise you block. Okay. So very simple solution. So whenever you want to get mutually exclusive access, you send a request and you block to wait to hear from the coordinator, and then at some point the coordinator is going to give you the lock. Okay? And then once you're done with the critical section, you have to send a message back to the coordinator saying, I release the lock. Okay? And then this is what the coordinator does. Whenever it receives a request, it sees whether the resource is currently in use by some other process or not. So if the resource is free, then you just grant the lock to this request. Okay? Now, if the resource is in use, which means that the lock has been granted to some process, then you queue this request. Okay? And then you dequeue them in FCFS order or FIFO order. Okay? And there's a picture here that shows basically this. Three is the coordinator here. These are the processes. Okay? This is the queue of pending requests, if any. Initially, the queue is empty. Okay? So one is going to send a request message. Since there is no lock has been granted, one can grab the lock, so you get the coordinator sends a message saying okay. Okay. So at this point, one still holds the lock and two wants to enter the critical section. It sends a request. Okay. It is going to have to block. No reply is going to be received because one still has the lock and this request is queued here. Okay. Some later point, one releases the lock, okay, and then two can get the lock. Okay. Now this works fine so long as there are no failures in the system. Okay. So I mean, you basically have a coordinator that decides which process gets the lock and guarantees to you that only one process gets the lock. And there are problems when there are failures. We'll look at that a little bit. Okay. So this is basically simulating centralized locking with blocking calls. Okay. And we will, it's probably clear that this is a fair scheme because locks are being granted in first come first serve order. It won't be starvation or anything like that. Okay, so long as every process, no process fails. And it's simple because there are only three messages per request. You start with the request message, you get back a grant message, and at some later point you do a release. Okay. Now the problem here is when things fail. Okay, so if the coordinator goes down, you will not get back a release grant message. Okay, so there's a single point of failure in this centralized scheme. Okay, because the coordinator is the one deciding, and so the basic problem is how will you detect whether the coordinator has gone down. If these are the only messages being exchanged in the system, you will never be able to detect the difference between a dead coordinator and a coordinator that is still waiting to give you the lock. Okay, because in neither of these two cases you will hear back. So you just send a request message and you block. Okay. Now if the coordinator is down, you never hear a reply. But if the coordinator is up but the lock has been given to some other process and you are waiting in a long queue, also you don't hear for a long time and you cannot distinguish between these two. Okay. Now the solution of course is you could have other types of messages that allow you to check whether the coordinator went down. Okay. You can just ping the coordinator, which is an independent message. So you have to keep track of the coordinator is dead, and if so you start a new leader election and you get the whole algorithm going again. The second problem arises where a process that holds a lock goes down, okay, and never releases the lock. in this case requests are going to be queued forever. Okay, so you have to somehow detect that scenario as well. If the process never releases the lock, then you will have to get back the lock from the process somehow. Okay. There are various ways to do this, which are not part of the scheme, but these are extensions of the scheme. Sometime back we talked about this in the context of lost RPC messages and so on. Okay, so one thing you could do is give the lock not for an indefinite period, but for a certain timeout value. Okay, so when you get a lock, you get it for, let's say, 30 seconds. Okay. The end of that 30 seconds, you may have to renew the lock, or you will be asked whether you want to continue holding the lock. Okay, this ensures that there is constant communication between the coordinator and the client processes. So if the timeout period expires, then it's assumed that if you don't renew your lock, you are going to have to give it away, give it back. Okay, so this guarantees that there won't be a process. If the process dies, for example, the coordinator just says wait for a timeout period. Okay, that's the period for which the lock was granted, and then it assumes that the lock has been returned to it, and then it can grant this lock to someone. So you can have extensions like this that help with the failure cases. Okay, but at the end of the day, it's still a very simple scheme, and if it is centralized, so in a large system, large distributed system, you will have a performance bottleneck. The coordinator has to do a lot of work. Any questions here? So the next algorithm is a decentralized algorithm. Okay, and here the processes will use voting to decide who gets the lock. Okay, so we'll assume that there are n processes. Okay, it says n replicas, but there are n processes, and as a coordinator for each process. Okay, so to acquire a lock, you just broadcast a message saying I want a lock. Okay, and then these coordinators vote to decide who gets the lock. So if you are the only process that has requested a lock, all the coordinators are going to say sure, go ahead. Okay, so majority of the coordinators agree, you get the lock. That's the algorithm. Okay. Now when there is contention, you have to decide. The coordinators have to decide who gets the lock, and they have to vote. Okay, so the voting scheme somehow has to guarantee that someone will win. Okay, so you could say if there is more than one request, you either process them in some order in which they arrived, or process them with the lowest process ID. You can use some technique that allows these coordinators to vote and ensure that only one of these processes win. Okay. And then that process gets to go next, and other requests are queued and so on. Yes, question.
What do you
assume n processes, your replica is, let's just assume n processes. Okay. And there's a coordinator per process. This coordinator is the, let's say it's a thread in your process that is going to vote. Okay, is this clear? What this technique does? So again, here the coordinator may crash and it may forget. In this case, when a coordinator crashes, it assumes that the process is also gone down. So you have to forget previous votes, and then you have to ensure that somehow the voting doesn't come back with no answer. Okay, so you have to ensure all of these cases. Again, we will not go into a lot of details into the failure case, because we will defer all of the discussion about failures to fault tolerance chapter, which is coming in a few classes. Okay, so just do remember that there are problems with any of these algorithms when there are failures. Okay. So that was a decentralized algorithm. So here is another one. Okay, this is called a Rickard and Agarwal algorithm, because these are the people who basically proposed it. So in this case, there are 2n-1 message exchanges. Okay, 2 times n-1 message exchanges, and this algorithm uses event ordering and timestamps. Okay, this is somewhat similar to what has been asked in the project. Okay, to decide order of events and figure out who gets to go next. Okay, so assume that there is no time synchronization or anything like that. So you want to ensure that there is some ordering that you decide. And this ordering is the order in which messages, the lock has been requested. Okay, if you decide on that ordering, that's the ordering on which you will grant the locks. Okay, that's the basic idea. So here is the algorithm. Okay, so let's assume that process K, okay, wants to enter the critical section. It is going to generate a new timestamp. And here the timestamp is, let's say, the Lamport's clock. Okay, just increment the timestamp. And then it is going to multicast or broadcast this request towards the remaining processes, saying, this is your request method, saying, I want to grab the lock. Okay, I'm process K, this is my logical clock value, and I want to get the lock. Okay? And then you have to wait until every one of these processes sends back a reply message. And the reply message essentially says, go ahead. Okay? So you block until everyone else has said, go ahead. Okay? And then you go ahead and grab the lock. Okay? So this is the process that wants to enter the critical section. Now what do the other processes do? Okay, so upon receiving a request message, okay, here is what the each process is going to do. You will send a reply if that process itself doesn't want the lock, meaning there is no contention locally. Okay? So if somebody is requesting a lock and you don't need the lock, you just send back a reply. Okay? Now if you are already in the critical section, you will not reply, you will wait until you come out of the critical section. Okay? So if you don't need the lock, you just send a reply. If you already have the lock, you wait, okay, until you send back a reply. Okay, now, suppose that you want to, you also want to grab the lock. Okay? So request message has come. And this is the case where you want to also enter the critical section, someone else also enter the critical section. So here you compare your Lamport's clock value with the clock value that has come. And whichever one is lower wins. Okay, because that's, since this is totally ordered multicast, okay, you basically have event ordering, and the Lamport's clock value tells you what the event ordering is. So if your clock value is higher, then the other process wins. If your clock value is lower, you win. Okay? So if each process executes this logic, then it's guaranteed that at any given time, only one process is going to get the lock. Okay? Is this clear why? Yes, question.
If a process has finished its critical section and there are several requests in a waiting queue.
Yes.
What do you need to
do? Okay. So if a process is already in the, so the question is related to the middle bullet, saying if you're already in the critical section, you do not reply, you wait. Okay. But when you come out of the critical section, there may be a queue of requests. Okay, multiple processes may have tried to enter the critical section. At that point, you simply pick the one with the lowest timestamp, okay, and reply to that.
You may pick the first one in a waiting queue?
Yes. Not first as in not in first come, first award, or first as in the one with the lowest timestamp. Okay, because the basic idea behind this is that every request for a lock is assigned a Lamport's clock value. Okay, and then you multicast this request. So the one with the, there are multiple processes contending for the lock, the one with the lowest timestamp gets to go next. Okay, because that's the, you're basically choosing the one in the order in which requests were made. That's the basic idea. Okay, and, remember that the Lamport's clock algorithm has to operate in parallel here. Every time you get a request with a timestamp, then you have to advance your Lamport clock, and all of that has to happen here. Yeah, that's not mentioned, but it's assumed that since you're maintaining a Lamport clock, the messages cause you to increment your clock values as well by doing the max of your local timestamp and the one that has come. Okay, so you do all of this. Any questions here? Yes.
I just want to follow up on this question.
Oh.
So after responding to the first request according to timestamp, what do you do with the rest of them? I mean, when do we...
Okay, the question is, what do you do with the rest? That's a good question, right? So the claim is you only need to reply to one, not to the rest. Okay, the assumption, because if there are multiple processes queued here, okay, so it's assumed that they all want to enter the critical section. Okay, and since every request is being broadcast to everyone else, okay, the process that is going to get the lock next, okay, would have also waited. Okay, put all these requests on its wait queue, so it would then reply to the next one and so on.
But this would also need to reply because the initial process will wait for reply from each process. So this process should also respond at some time.
The initial process will wait for, yes, everyone has to reply, otherwise you don't get to go, right?
Yeah, so when does this one respond?
The one that currently holds the lock?
No, the one which had initially been locked for a long time to the first in the queue, but not to the rest.
Right. So once you are basically, you could do several things. You could reply to the first one, okay, And then once that gets the critical section, you don't, and if you don't want to contend anymore, then for the remaining request, you're basically back to this case. So you could just say, I don't care, and let the others fight it out. So essentially, the contention is only between someone who wants to enter the critical section, right? So it's only those processes have to decide. If you don't, if you're not in part of the contention, you can just send a reply because you don't care one way or another. Okay, it doesn't impact you. So that's the basic idea.
So you can just respond to all ones?
Yes.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, the nice thing about, so this is just a very simple example. And then, so every request is broadcast to everyone and you compare the timestamp and you decide who gets to go next. So in this case, process 0 has a logical Lamport's clock value of 8. So it gets to go next, and then once it is done, it is going to send OK to the second one that wants to enter and so on. Okay, so that's basically, this shows how the algorithm works. But the interesting property here is that the algorithm is fully distributed, okay, fully decentralized. There is no coordinator, but this has introduced, this has not made the algorithm better. In some sense, it's made the algorithm worse because there are n points of failure. Okay. In the centralized case, it was the coordinator that was the key entity. If the coordinator failed, the system would stop. Nobody would be able to make progress in the system. Here, since you're waiting for replies from everyone, and you have everyone has to tell you to go ahead, if anyone fails, you will not get a reply from that process, and even if there is no contention for the lock, you will not be able to go ahead and enter your critical section. Okay? So this is one of these few cases where by making the algorithm fully distributed, from a failure perspective, you don't make the algorithm better, you made the algorithm worse. Okay? And the other problem is that every process is involved in all decisions. Okay? Suppose that there are n processes and only a small fraction of them are even worried about the critical section and the rest are just doing something else. They still have to send reply messages. Okay? They still have to process these request messages and reply messages even though they have nothing, no interest in grabbing the lock at any point in time. Okay? So all processes are involved in all decisions regardless of their interests or lack thereof in the lock. So this basically introduces additional processing burden at all of these processes. Okay? So not only is the failure case worse, now the load on each process is also increased. Okay? In the centralized case, only the coordinator has to bear the burden of additional processing. Okay, it had to process all requests, and now here everyone has to do that. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind, that both the failure properties worse as well as the load is not spread, you increase the load on everyone, okay, rather than spreading the load. Yes.
And that means we tend to use centralized algorithm instead of.
Yeah. So question is which one? So I'll show a comparison, right, and then you can decide which one is better. Just wait. So there's one more to go before I come to a comparison of all four. Okay. So the fourth one is a token ring algorithm. Okay. So here what happens is, assume that there are n processes. Okay, here n is 10, and you just number them from 0 to n minus 1. Okay, and how you number them is not material. Let's just assume that everyone has a unique ID, and your number tells you who your neighbors are because these numbers form a logical ring. Okay, so this is basically, let's say, an Ethernet. Okay, so these are the machines. They just have these numbers, but that's the logical ring that has formed as a result of this numbering scheme. So any process I has two neighbors, I minus 1 and I plus 1 mod n. Okay? So 7 has two neighbors, 0 and 6. Physically, they may not be neighbors. Physically, they may just be on a LAN or they may be apart. Doesn't matter. But you have formed a ring. And now what happens is there's a token that circulates in the ring. And you have to wait until the token comes to you. And that tells you that you have access to the critical section. Okay, so the basically token is a message saying you have a mutually exclusive access to the resource. Okay, so the token just circulates in the ring. So let's say 0 starts with the token. Okay, then once it's done, it gives it to 1. Okay, 1 then if it's interested in entering the critical section, at that point it goes ahead. Otherwise, if it's not interested, it just passes the token on. Okay, and so on. So if you want to enter the critical section, you do nothing. You just wait until the token comes to you. Once the token comes to you, you can enter the critical section. And then once you are done, you send it to your neighbor. Okay, so that's the basic idea. Okay, is this clear what's going on here? So very simple. There's no request to be made. You just say wait. And then it's assumed that, so if the assumption is that every process is going to exit its critical section, meaning that it's not going to go into an infinite loop in its critical section, which means it will hold the token forever. Let's eliminate that case. So if you exit your critical section, it's guaranteed that you will send the token to the next process. Okay, this ensures that the token will keep circulating, and at some point in time, the token will come to you. Okay, and then you can enter the critical section. Okay, so in the no failure case where every critical section is finite, it should be clear that without sending any messages whatsoever, you will be able to enter the critical section at some point when the token comes to you. Okay, the problem arises when some process that is holding the token goes down. Okay, so this is a scenario where the algorithm is not going to work. So if 7 holds the critical the token and it fails, okay, the token is going to stop circulating. Okay, at this point, any other process that wants to enter the critical section is going to be blocked forever. Okay, so then you are in trouble. So you have to detect this scenario. Okay, so to ensure correctness in the presence of failures, you will have to detect the loss of a token, okay, and regenerate the token. And there are various ways to do this. So if you know anything about networking or local area networks, you may know that a token ring algorithm was one way by which LANs were implemented at one point in time. Okay? Today, LANs are implemented using either Ethernet or wireless networks, but at one point in time, there were two competing technologies. There was a token ring algorithm where if you had a machine, you just plop it into a ring, and then it gets to transmit on the network only when it gets the token. And this also, the reason you had this was, if in Ethernet what happens is if two machines transmit on the network at the same time, there's a collision and then one of them has to back off and eventually one wins. Okay? The token ring algorithm avoids collisions because you get mutually exclusive access to your LAN. Okay? When you get the token, you transmit. If you want to transmit but you don't have the token, you have to wait until the token comes to you. Okay? So this was the way the LAN technology for token ring worked. Okay? Now, clearly, even in that case, they have to solve this problem where if you have the token, okay, your PC has the token, you switch the PC off. Okay? So you haven't passed the token on to someone else, your token is gone. Okay, then what do you do? Okay, so your problems like this. So what they did was they added or enhanced the scheme to ensure that you can only hold the token for a certain amount of time. Okay, so you may be in a critical section. But you are only given the token for some amount of time. Okay, so and let's assume that you cannot be in a critical section for more than some bounded amount of time, whatever that bound be, doesn't matter. Let's assume that you bound the amount of time which any process can spend in a critical section. That's the maximum amount of time you can have the token. Okay, so you have to basically give the token to then your neighbor once that time period elapses. Okay. So this guarantees that if there are n processes and t is the maximum amount of time any process can hold the token, you have to see a token once every n times t, time units. Okay. So if you don't get a token in this much time unit, you know that the token is lost. Okay. This is how you detect the loss of a token. Okay. By bounding the period of time any process can hold the token. Okay. Now that's just detecting the loss. Now that doesn't tell you who gets to regenerate the token. Because if k processes simultaneously figure out n time t time units are passed and the token is lost, okay, you don't want all n of them to suddenly regenerate a token. Now there's more than one token, which is also bad. Okay, you don't want either the zero token or more than one token. Okay, so you want to ensure that once the token loss has been detected, there is some coordinator somewhere and that's the only process that can regenerate the token. So there's guaranteed that only one token will be regenerated, no more than one. Okay. So there are techniques like that were added to the token ring network to ensure that problems wouldn't arise. Yes, question.
Say in this case if 6 goes down and has a token.
Yes.
Say all the rest have a specific time and they will be expecting a token.
Yes.
So that time will be ordered accordingly. Like 7's time and expect a token will be much earlier than 0 or 1.
Right.
So if 7, in that case 7's time will expire before.
Right. Yeah. So, question being asked is, since each process has seen that token at different points in time, there'll be one process where the timer for this n time t timer is going to expire first, so why not let it have regenerate the dough? Okay? This works fine if you assume again that your all clocks are going to tick at the same rate. Okay? So I may have a buggy clock that ticks much faster. Okay, so my timer may be 30 seconds. Okay? But I actually my timer expires within 20 seconds because my clock really ticked faster and this 30 seconds really 20 seconds of real time. In this case, you are going to have problems. Okay, so you should never depend on anything like that to guarantee that there will be only one tick. Okay, so someone else's timer, someone else with a fast clock, their timer may expire first and they may regenerate the token. So if 5's timer goes off first and it regenerates the token and it's holding it, okay, and it's doing something, and then 7's timer expires just after that, okay, because it has still not received the token from 5, so you will regenerate the token. Okay, so you will have problems like this. So it's best to elect a coordinator, and that coordinator job is to maintain this timer rather than have everyone maintain the timer. Okay, then you have to obviously detect the loss of the coordinator. And so there are many problems that arise that one has to fix. But with the basic algorithm, yes, you have a question here.
Well, the token being algorithm has some performance problem. For example, if one get a token, but I don't know whether I will need a token in the future, so I will send the token to the neighbor.
Yes.
But after a while, I found I need to know and on the critical region, so I have to wait.
Yes.
If the network is large, so I have to wait a long time to get a token to enter into the
yes. Yes, so as the size of the network increases, clearly the amount of time you have to wait until the token circulates and comes back to you will keep going up. Okay, so that's absolutely true. So in this token ring network, you can't let the ring grow arbitrarily large. So think of a LAN case, right? You want to transmit something on the network. Okay, but if this is a very large token ring, let's say 800 machines, that's the number of machines we have in this department, they're all on a ring, and each of them gets a token for 1 second, you will be able to transmit only once every 800 seconds. So you have a problem, right? So what you have to do is you cannot limit the number of machines on the ring and so on. Okay, this is in the LAN case. Now, in principle, the algorithm doesn't care how many you have. I mean, clearly, the performance or the latency for entering the critical section will keep going up as the size of the LAN increases. But that's not a problem with the algorithm itself. I mean, that's the way the token ring works. Okay. So you can't have multiple rings in the mutual exclusion case, because if there's only one shared resource, okay, you will have to wait. There is no other way to handle that. Okay, so, yes.
If the network is large and you have to transmit the message, the token ring between different nodes.
Well, let's decouple the LAN discussion from the mutual exclusion problem. Okay? The mutual exclusion problem, if there are n processes and all n of them want to enter the critical section, there will be some process that gets to go last. Okay? The same is true here. As the size of the group increases and if the amount of contention grows, the amount of time for which you wait will also increase. That is independent of the token ring algorithm. That just says that there's a shared resource that's in heavy demand, you will have to keep waiting for long periods of time until you get to go. Okay, assuming it's fair, you will have to wait, you will get to go one every n turns. Okay, so that's a different problem. Now in the token ring case, in the LAN scenario, there is a problem, because if you are doing some interactive, let's say you have done an SSH, if you have to wait until your type goes and reflects back to you, that gives bad interactive performance. So there they limit the size of the token ring for performance reasons. Okay? So you would have mutually exclusive token rings, and then they are connected by routers. That's the way they work. Any other questions here?
So why don't you construct a more complex graph? It's a ring, I mean. Maybe every node has its own privilege, so you can arrange that optimal. It's a more complex graph.
So you're saying make it more compact. Right. So in a mutually, so if you're doing mutual exclusion, okay, regardless of how you construct the ring, even in any of these previous algorithms, right, if there are 100 processes, they all want the lock at the same time. Okay, the requests are going to be queued up. Okay, Okay, and then you will, some process will have to wait for a long period of time. The one that entered the wanted to made the request the last. Same is true here. Okay, the size of the ring, if there is no contention, if let's only 5 and 7 are contending, okay, regardless of the size of the ring, then the token will circulate quickly and it's only going to be held and back at these two nodes. Okay. But if everyone starts contending, then you have to wait. That's the point. Okay, so that's the... So making it smaller doesn't help. The problem is how many of these want to enter the critical section at the same time. That is going to determine the time for which you wait.
Okay. So should there be a token for each critical section in the footprint? There are more than one critical section. Do we have more than one token?
So question is, that's a good point. If there is more than one critical section, will you have more than one token? So you need one token per shared resource. Okay. So there may be k shared resources in which k tokens will circulate. This is like a lock, right? So if you have k independent shared data structures, each is protected by an independent lock. Okay. So in this case, each of them will translate to a token. So if these are two critical sections that access the same resource, you will have to use the same token. But if they're independent resources, you get different tokens.
Yes. Wouldn't you initiate token D? The player is no one who want to enter the critical region.
Yeah. If there's no one, then that. Yeah. So in this case, the token is just going to circulate. That's wasted work, but that's the way it goes. In this algorithm, in the centralized case, nothing is going to happen, for example. Okay, so here is the comparison. So that the question you asked is probably will be answered here. Okay, so there's centralized, decentralized, distributed, token ring, messages that are exchanged. In the centralized case, it's 3. The distributed case, it's 3 times the number of coordinators. In the Ricardo and Agarwala, it's 2 times n minus 1. This is the Lamport's clock. The token ring, it can be 1 to infinity. The reason it's infinity is, if the same question that was asked, if nobody wants the lock, the token is just going to keep circulating. Passing the token is a message, right? So the token may just circulate for a long period of time, for hours, before somebody wants to get the lock. Okay, so you have wasted a lot of messages, even though there is no contention or no one wanting to enter the critical section. So that's the reason it goes from here to here. Okay. So there is delay and there are problems that are mentioned there, which we already discussed. So I'm not going to go into them. Okay, let's, if there are no other questions, are there questions here? We're going to move on to the next topic.
What's
M and K? So M is the, so here it's a delay before entering the critical section. Let me see. So K is the number of processes. So in the decentralized case, let's go back here. So M is the number of processes, and I think K is the number of processes that are contending for the resource. I think that's what it was. Okay. All right. So transactions is the next topic. Okay, so here I need to provide some background before we actually look at some algorithms. So and this follows naturally from the discussion on mutual exclusion. Okay. So what transactions do is they provide a higher level of atomicity for processing in distributed system. Yeah, I'll give some examples. But what you can do with a transaction? Okay, a transaction is somewhat similar to a mutual exclusion or a critical section, but it guarantees to you that either the entire critical section is executed or nothing is executed, okay, from the perspective of other participants in this distributed system. Okay. So that's the problem of atomicity, and I'll come back to that in just a moment. Let me just illustrate why you may want to provide atomicity at a higher level, okay, even though you may be accessing individual resources. Okay. So to understand this, let's take a bank account example. Okay. Let's assume there are 3 accounts, A, B, and C. Okay. This one has $100 balance, here is $200 and this $300. Okay. So now there may be processes that are running in the bank computing system that are making modification depending on whether deposits are coming in or withdrawals are being made and so on. Okay. So one way you probably will implement this is for each account, you may put a lock. Yes, so if there are two processes, one wants to deposit and another wants to make a withdrawal from the same account, you may think that let's just put a lock on this account. So only one process can grab the lock, make modifications to the balance, and then the next one gets to go next. Okay? This is one simple way to implement the banking system. Okay? Now, the example here shows that that is necessary but not sufficient for overall correctness. Okay? So we'll still assume that there is a lock on each account, but here is what can happen. So suppose you want client 1 wants to transfer $4 from A to B, and client 2 wants to transfer $3 from C to B. Okay, these are two operations that you want to make. Okay, so here is what client 1 does and here is what client 2 does. Okay, so client 1 has to read the balance of A. Okay, since it's transferring $4, it decrements A's balance. Okay, and then it's going to read B. Okay, and then it's going to increment B's balance. Okay, now this dimension is time. Okay, so these are the order in which various operations are taking place. And we'll assume client 1 and client 2 are running in parallel. Okay. So here is client 2. Okay, so client 2 now reads C's balance and it decrements it by 3. Okay, and then it reads B's balance and it increments it. But the problem arises because of the interleaving of these operations. Okay. So if this is the interleaving, so this is each time step and this is the interleaving, you will actually end up with an incorrect result. Okay. The incorrect result is because what you have ended up with at the end of this is B's balance is 2 or 4. Okay? But since there is $4 coming from client 1 and 3 coming from client 2, you should have gotten a $7 increase, not a $4 increase. And the reason is what has happened here is that these two read requests proceed one after another and read the same account and then they overwrite each other's results. Okay? Because B's bank balance has been read by client 1, and before it could increment it, client 2 also read the same balance and it wrote 2 or 3, and then B went ahead and overwrote that. Okay. So what you would have rather had was have this entire sequence of operations be protected into one lock and then causing client 2 to block until all of these run, and then when client 2 reads it, it actually is 2 or 4, not 200. Okay. That would have incremented it to 2 or 7, or the other way around. Client 2 runs first, increments it, and then client 1 runs next. That's the illusion you want to provide for correctness. Okay, so merely protecting the account with a lock doesn't help. You want to provide higher level correctness guarantees, and that is essentially what transactions allow you to do. Okay, so this is what you want to happen. Okay, so all these things happen and then this happens. Okay. Even though they may be running in parallel, this is how you want the results to show up in your system. Okay. So the notion of transactions, okay, is one where you protect a sequence of operations with and make them look like a single atomic operation. So the whole thing happens or nothing happens. Okay. And to elaborate on this, all transactional systems provide what are called ACID properties. Okay. So if you've taken a course on databases, okay, you probably know something about ACID properties. So each letter of this acronym means something. Okay, so A in ACID stands for atomicity, okay, which is the all or nothing. Okay, you either want all four of these things to happen or nothing. Okay, you don't want A to get decremented and these operations to fail. So this $4 would have then disappeared. Okay, it's taken out of A's account, but it's not showed up in B's account. So you want to have both of these things happen or nothing happens. Okay, meaning that the entire operation failed. Okay, so that's atomicity. Consistency says that you take the system from one consistent state to another. Okay. So the best way to illustrate this is to go back to this example. This has landed the system in an inconsistent state. You started with a consistent state, which was this. You did this set of operations and you ended up in an inconsistent state. Okay. So you never want this. Every sequence of operations, you take the system from one consistent state to another. Okay, this ensures that the correctness property is never violated. Okay. Isolation, which is also called serializability, says that the effects are only visible at the end of the transaction, and the effects are as if all of these operations actually happened atomically and one after another in sequence. Okay. So this says that these two sets of operations, the effect is as if this ran first and this transaction ran next, okay, in sequence. Although they may have been running in parallel, the end result looks as if this one ran first and this one ran next. okay, because you, that's the way the results show. Okay. And durability just says that once you write, the transaction finishes. Okay, the changes become visible on disk, and then it is final, meaning you cannot undo those changes. Until the transaction commits, you can kill the transaction, and it will basically roll back the system state to before what the transaction did, meaning that the transaction quits somewhere in between here. Okay, you have to undo the effects of these operations, meaning that you will have to go back and restore A's balance back to 100. Okay? But once the transaction commits, you cannot undo that, and those results are final, the changes are visible, and they are assumed to be correct. Okay, that's the durability property. Is this clear? What asset properties stand for? We'll now look at how you go about implementing some of these. Okay. So let me now give a couple examples, and then we will look at how to implement a transactional system, and that's the real goal of what we are getting at. So here is how you write transactions. Okay, very simple. You can protect any set of operations with a begin transaction and an end transaction. And it is assumed that anything encapsulated between a begin and end executes as a single atomic unit. And if the transaction aborts, all of these statements have to be undone. Okay, so you take back the system to before the begin. Okay, that's what the begin and end does. Abort allows you to abort if you want to kill the transaction at any point. And then you can have reads and writes within the transaction that allow you to read some state and write to some state. Okay, here's a simple example of an airline reservation. Okay, so you want to basically book a ticket that involves multiple hops. Okay, so what the transaction does is it goes and looks at each individual flight in that hop, okay, and it makes a reservation. So your reservation succeeds if you get flight confirmation or rather seat confirmation on all the flights or none. Okay, if there's any one that does fail, then you say you cannot book on this book a ticket on this route. Okay, so here you say reserve fly from the New York and Paris flight. If this is full, you just abort the transaction. You reserve from Paris to Athens and Athens to Delhi. If all of these work, then you got a ticket that takes you from this point to that point. Okay, that's the notion of a transaction in an airline reservation system. Okay. So now, I just want to give the distinction between nested and distributed transactions. Okay, in a nested transaction, what can happen is between a begin transaction and an end transaction, there could be another transaction encapsulated in. There's another begin and an end. Okay, so the whole thing also looks like a transaction, and every transaction that's nested in between also gives you asset properties. Okay, the reason you may want to do that is you are making a travel booking. Okay, you want to make a flight reservation and a hotel reservation. And you want both to work. You want to get the flight as well as the hotel. If you don't get one, then your flight, your travel plans don't work out. Okay, so what you do is you have a nested transaction, okay, so that both succeed. And then within each, you have a transaction. You do a flight reservation, that's a transaction of its own. You do a hotel reservation, that's a transaction of its own. Okay, so you want each of these individual ones to succeed as a transaction, and you want the whole thing also want to succeed as a transaction. Okay, so this is called a nested transaction. Yes, question here. The sub-transactions don't need durability. In this case, in the nested transaction, the sub-transactions could be undone. Okay? So you do need durability, but in a sub-transaction, the commit barrier is actually when the nested transaction ends, not when each of these individual ones end. Okay? So you delay the commit until the whole thing, because once you commit here, you will not be able to undo it. Okay? So this transaction will commit, but you block the commit until this point. That's all. And then it becomes durable. Yes, question.
What is the advantage of having these multiple sub-transactions instead of having like one big transaction?
What's the advantage of having this independent transaction? These could be independent databases. Okay. The notion of a transaction is only visible within a single database, right? So the airline database is in the airline reservation system. Let's say it's airline X, and the hotel database is run by hotel Y. So you will have to encapsulate, so the system that is making the reservation for you, let's say it's an online system, has a transaction, and it sort of spawns several smaller transactions, and it waits for the whole thing to end.
That's
all the way it is. Yes, that's the way it's. So these are two independent databases, and then you run transactions in each. Okay. Now the notion of a distributed transaction is shown in this other picture. Here it's slightly different aspect. So here what happens is, rather than having independent databases, your database is distributed across multiple machines or multiple disks. Okay, you assume that it's a large database, so it cannot reside on any single place. Okay? So it's distributed across multiple disks. So, but to the rest of the world, this looks like one logical database. Okay? So your transaction just looks like a normal transaction, except that when it's executing, it's spawning operations at individual disks. So it also has sub-transactions. So here, let's say the transaction requires, so for example, the airline reservation system may have been split into multiple databases. So there's one database that handles the US to Europe booking and another database that's handling the Europe to Asia bookings. But to the rest of the world, it just looks like one logical database, which is the picture that's shown here. So to make your flight reservation, you still have to go to this individual components within your distributed database and execute something. And then you still give ACID properties across the whole thing. Okay, is this clear? What the distinction is? Okay. So here it's still the same database as far as the rest of the world is concerned. Okay, so that's the important point to keep in mind. So now what we'll do is try to understand how to implement a transactional system, and that's where I think with all this background we are headed. So the first way so we'll look at two different ways to implement this. Okay, the first one is called private workspaces. Okay, so what happens in a private workspace is conceptually each transaction that is running gets its own copy of all files and objects. So think of it as if when you run the transaction, you get your own copy of the entire database. Okay, so as a database, when you start a transaction, you get your own private copy. You can do whatever changes you want to that private copy. Okay, so now those changes that you made to this private copy are not visible until the transaction commits. Okay? Once the transaction commits, you look at what changes you have made to this database and you propagate that back to the main database, and that's where the changes become visible. Yeah, that's exactly what is shown in this picture. Okay, so here you have a database, and let's suppose these are records or entries in the database. Here's the index, each of which points to these records. Okay, so when the transaction begins, it gets its own copy of this index and own copy of the blocks, and it can make some modifications. So let's assume that it entered a new record into the database. Okay, it appended a record, so, and it also modified 0. So 0 becomes 0 prime, 3 becomes 3 prime, and there are new copies that have appeared. Okay. But this is private, and the main database doesn't know any of this at this point because the transaction is still running. Okay, at some later point, the transaction is going to commit. If it aborts, we just throw this away. Okay, and then the main database is untouched. Very simple. Abort is very simple because every change is private. Okay, it's made to a private copy, you just throw that copy away in there. But if you want to commit, then you have to look at your private copy, see what modifications have been done, and you propagate them back. So in this case, 0 has been modified and 3 has been added. Okay? So when the commit happens, then the index to 0 has to point to the new record, new version of the record 0, and then you have to insert 3 into the index and you get 3 becomes visible. Okay? At this point, everything becomes visible to the outside world. So that's the notion of a private workspace. Now, conceptually, this is simple to understand. Okay? But when you implement it, you can't really make a new copy every time a transaction starts running. Okay, that's just not feasible. You may have 1 gigabyte database, one transaction, because you can't copy that 1 gigabyte. And so here is your own copy of this 1 gigabyte of data. Okay, that doesn't work. So you use what are called copy on write optimizations. Okay, in other words, you can optimize for reads by not making any copies. Okay, reads doesn't matter. Why do you want a copy if you're only going to read the same data? Only place where this matters is writes. Okay, so when you do copy on write, what you do is you get your own copy, but that copy is actually pointing to the master copy. Okay, and as you modify each of this, then you actually create two copies. Okay, so in this case, as soon as you modify 0, you make a copy of that block 0. And then you put the new version in your copy and the old version is still in the old block. Okay, this is called copy on write. Okay, you make a copy only when you touch and modify something. And then when you enter 3, you modify your index. Okay, and then when you commit, you will basically merge these changes back. That's how you do private workspaces. Any questions? Yes. is this principle similar to the way code versions? So there are some similarities in a source code version control system. What you do is you check out a local copy. Okay? But in that case, you actually get your own copy. In this case, you don't want to make copy needlessly. Okay? So if you do a CVS or an SVN checkout, right? So the repository is remote. You will actually get a copy of those files. So there's a real copy being made. Here, the copy is only being made logically, not in real. In that sense, it is different. But otherwise, it's the same thing. You get it, and then you check it back. Okay? So in some sense, that between the checkout and the check-in, that's like your own transaction. You're making local copies. Nobody else can see it. When you check it in, then everyone can see it. To that extent, it is similar. Okay, but the big difference is here, you're not really making copies unless you have to. So how does it ensure consistency? So I have not mentioned how do you have concurrent transactions executing and get serializability yet. This picture is only showing one transaction, which is this one. Okay, it's making more in known changes. So another transaction can start when this is running. It gets a copy of this. Okay, it will start making modifications. So what you want is to ensure that you will not override one another. In other words, you don't want this bad example that we talked about to happen. Okay, if you basically get client one's copy, okay, so this is the database, okay, both of these are transactions, right? So you basically, client one gets this, a copy of this, client two also gets a copy of this, and then they could override one another and end up with this. You don't want that to happen. Okay? Now, private workspaces by themselves don't guarantee you that. You have to add locking and concurrency control on top of that, and we'll talk about that. Okay? Any other questions? So all the intelligence has to come when you commit, which is you're propagating these changes back. If in the meantime someone else has modified that block, the entire transaction will have to abort. That's the way it will work. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Yeah. The second way to implement this is called write-ahead logs. Okay, so what happens in this system, because it's also a transactional system, is that you don't get your own copy. Rather, you make changes directly in place to the records. Okay? So if you want to modify block or record zero, you'll go and start modifying it. Okay? And if the transaction commits successfully and there is no conflict, everything is fine. Okay? Problems arise when there is some other transaction that makes some changes that conflicts with your transaction. Okay? In this case, one transaction has to abort. Okay? But to abort, you need to now restore the state of the system to what it was before the transaction began. So to do this, you have to keep track of what changes you have made and what was the value before you changed it. Okay, so suppose you are modifying a variable, that you add, let's say, $5 to this bank account. Okay, if the transaction aborts, you need to restore it to before the transaction began. So you need to know what operation you did so you can undo that operation. Okay? For this, you maintain a log, and that's what the write-ahead log is. Okay, so prior to making any change, so you're modifying the database in place. No copies, you're just actually modifying the real database. Okay? But prior to making any change, the transaction is going to keep a log. The log says, this is what I'm doing for each operation. Okay? So if the transaction aborts, you actually replay the log in the reverse order and undo all of those changes. And I'll show an example in just a moment. Okay? So you have the transaction ID or the block number or the original value or the new value. So to undo it, you write this back to the record. Okay, so let's look at, here is a simple transaction, and that's the log. Okay, so there are two values in this database, X and Y. Okay, this is the transaction. So you increment X by 1, you increment Y by 1, and then you set X is Y times Y. Okay, so as each of this operation executes, you write to the log saying X had a value of 0, I made the value of X 1. Okay, then you say Y had a value of 0, I made the value of Y 2, and then you say X had a value of 1, I made it 4. So this is what the log is. Okay. At this point, if you abort it, then you have to go back and rewrite. First, you'll overwrite the value of X with 1, then overwrite the value of Y with 0, then overwrite the value of X, which you overwrote here, by again 0. At that point, you'll get back X equals to 0, Y equals to 0, which is what it was before the transaction. Yes. Force logs on commit. Okay, so what this is basically saying is that when the commit happens, okay, so this is the right head log, right? So when the commit happens, then the commit is successful, then you don't have to do anything to the log. The log is just written out to disk.
But it's already written out to disk, right?
Yes, so you are writing to stable storage. Just wait a second. No, force. Yeah, I guess force just means that you don't worry about it anymore. You basically those entries are just in the log. You could delete them. Otherwise, the log just continues to grow. Not that you write it to stable storage. You have to write to stable storage while you are executing. But this also allows you to recover from failures. Right? If the transaction may abort not because somebody else wrote, but because the process crashed, in which case you'd abort a transaction in rollback. Okay, for that reason, you have to write the log to stable storage. Okay, so the next problem is one where you decide which transactions get to commit and which ones have done something that conflicts. Okay, and so this is the problem of concurrency control. Okay, so what this concurrency control allows you to do is it introduces parallelism in the system. Okay, multiple transactions can execute at the same time. Okay, if they operate on independent parts of your database, okay, then they can all operate in parallel. There is no conflict. But if some transactions are now operating on the same records, then you want to ensure asset properties, which means you don't want one to override the changes of another. You want serializability and all of that. And this is precisely what concurrency control algorithms allow you to do. Okay, they ensure maximum parallelism without violating correctness or consistency. Okay, this may mean that some transactions may have to abort or they may have to block. Okay, if they are doing a conflicting operation, there are two types of concurrency control operation. One that allow, or rather concurrency control algorithm, one that allows you to make this conflicting change and then later on you will have to abort and roll back the transaction. The other one will cause you to block. So if you go ahead at this point, you will end up with a conflict. So better to wait, let the other one finish and then you go ahead. Okay, so there are two aspects and we'll look at both types of concurrency control algorithm. Okay, so let me start with some pictures here. So here is how you implement your entire transactional system. Okay, so this is the transaction manager that deals with begin and end. It does some of the logging and so on. Okay, there's a scheduler, and this is where a lot of the intelligence comes in. Okay, this is the one that is implementing either locks or release, or it is going to timestamp operations, which will then later on allow you to see if there were any conflicts, okay, that require you to roll back. So the scheduler is basically where the heart of the concurrency control algorithm actually is. And then the data manager is simply reading or writing records from your disk or your database. Okay. Now in the distributed case, it's the same. So your database is now distributed across multiple machines. So you have to have a scheduler that is on resides on each machine, but it has to interact with other schedulers, okay, because this is after all implementing locking. In this case, locking becomes distributed. So you want to make sure that no conflicts arise. Okay, and then there's a data manager which is reading or writing to local disks. Okay. So it should be clear that the notion of private workspaces, okay, works very well for the distributed case as well. Okay. So what in that case, rather than making a copy of a local database, you just make a copy of the entire distributed database. You make your changes, and at commit time, you see if there is any conflict. If so, the whole transaction is going to roll back. Okay. So now let's talk about serializability and understand how to implement various concurrency control algorithms. Okay. So now we'll assume that there are three transactions, and they're all executing in parallel. Okay. So each of them is modifying the same variable X. So what happens in each case is you set the value of X to 0. This one increments it by 1, that increments it by 2, and this increments it by 3. Okay. And you can have arbitrary interleaving of these individual operations. Okay. And we will not restrict the interleaving. Okay. All we want to do is to ensure that the end of these three transactions, you want to only accept those results that are valid. And the results that are valid are the ones that ensure serializability, which means that the result is such that if the operation, these transactions are executed one after another in some sequence, you end up with that result. So here are three schedules in which these operations executed, and two of them end up with a legal state and the third one does not. So here is one. So this is x equal to, so this basically it actually executes in sequence. The first two operations go first and then these two go next and these two go third. So you end up with x equals to 3 at the end of this, valid. It's valid because it's serializable. It says that these sequence of operations end up with a state such that if this had gone first and this had gone next and this had gone third, then you would have ended up with that result, okay, which is exactly what you have. Okay, here's another one. Okay, so here you basically, again, if you look at it, and you basically end up with x equals to 3. Okay, this is also accepted by the transactional system as a valid state. But the important thing to note here is an intermediate state is invalid, but we'll still accept the result. Okay, so in other words, what happens is this one executes first, okay, x equals to 0, then that goes next, okay, and then this executes, so you end up with x equals to 1 at this point. Okay, and when this executes, you basically set x equals to x plus 2. Okay, so if these two are now executing in parallel, that may end up with some incorrect result, but we'll still accept it because what only matters is what happens at the end of all of these operations. Okay, so it's in the end, result is x equals to 3, we'll still take it. Yes, question.
When you say equivalent to some serializable schedule, you mean like semantically equivalent, in the sense like the final result in this case is equal to 3?
Yes. Yes.
Or do you mean like the statement, interleaving statements are basically?
No. The interleaving state, so by serializability we mean that the end result is such that the transactions had executed one after another, but when they're actually executed, they can be in any arbitrary interleave. In other words, if I actually showed you the state of the system before and the state of the system after, and said, is this a valid state if these three transactions were executing in parallel? Then if you find any serializable schedule, then you are in valid state. So in this case, the system began with x equal to 0. Okay? And if I gave you x equal to 3 and said, is this a valid state after this three transaction executed in parallel? So what you could do is you take that transaction and construct some order. You look at the result if you have T1, T2, T3 executing in this order, or T3, T2, T1. So you look at all possible combinations of sequential execution. And if you find one where this is the end result, you accept that end result. That's called serializability. You don't care which order they went in. You just want to find one order, one sequence in which they would have executed and you would have ended up with that end result. And then you will say then it is serializable. Okay? Although when they're actually executing, they are executing in parallel. Okay? Is this clear? So to understand this, let's now look at the last state. Okay? So here you basically end up with x equals to 5 because this is x equal to 0 because 2 and this becomes 5. Okay? So now if I say you start with x equal to 0 and you end up with x equals to 5, is there some sequence of these transactions that would give me this end result? Okay, so you can construct any possible sequence. You will never end up with x equals to 5 in this case. Okay, the reason is any transaction in this sequence, let's suppose you pick some transaction that goes last. Okay, that transaction always resets the value of x to 0. And then basically sets the value of x or increments it by either 1, 2 or 3. Okay? So the only possible end results in this case is x equals to 1, x equals to 2 or x equals to 3 are the only three valid states of any serializable order because of the way these transactions are constructed. So if you end up with x equals to 5, this says it's illegal because no matter in what order sequence you execute this transaction, you will never end up with x equals 5. Okay? Is this clear? Any questions here? This is important to understand all the remaining parts of concurrency control. Any questions at all? Okay, so yes, you have a question.
Seems pretty expensive to be able to guarantee that you're going to get the final result.
Yeah. Okay. So it seems pretty expensive. So if you actually do this manual check, it is expensive. Okay, so we look at concurrency control algorithms that are more efficient. But what this slide is illustrating is what serializability means. Okay. What's an efficient algorithm to implement serializability, we'll look at. That's concurrency control. Okay. But I'm just saying, if I gave you this example and asked you to hand verify, you just have to find one ordering. Okay, let's say the ordering ends up T3, T1, T2. If you say if you execute them in this order, this is the result, then you accept the result. Say this is valid. Okay, so that's all I was illustrating here to understand. So now we'll talk about how do you do this in an efficient way. Okay. So the first one is where there are no locks whatsoever. Okay. So here we assume that the transaction is modifying shared state, but there are no locks in the system. This is called optimistic concurrency control. Okay. So the transaction in this case does whatever it wants, okay, but only at commit time it checks, did I do something that is conflicting? Okay. If the answer is yes, at that point you roll back the entire transaction. If not, you just let the transaction commit. So, yes, it's good modify that. How it is implemented is immaterial. It could be private workspaces or write-ahead lock. Both allow you a way to roll back. Okay? So long as you have a way to roll back, it doesn't matter how you implement it. Okay? But the basic idea, so clearly it works well with private workspaces, but even with logging, you have ability to undo, so it doesn't matter. Okay? So the insight here is that if you have large databases, concurrent transactions are likely to operate on independent, mutually exclusive parts of the database. So why bother with locks? Okay? If transaction 1 is accessing, let's say, record 5 and transaction 2 is accessing records 10 and 11, locking is adding needless overhead. Okay? Both of them would have been granted locks because there is, let's say, record level locking. Okay? So you have the overhead of grant and release when there is no contention. Okay? So if conflicts are rare, then this works very well. It basically says I'm going to depend on luck. And the luck is that when I'm executing, no one else is executing and accessing these records at the same time. Okay? So when the load is low and conflicts are rare, optimistic concurrency control works very well. Okay? Because you only check at commit time, and if there is no conflict, you basically go ahead and commit. Okay? Yes, your question. Yes. So the question is, how are index changes handled? So typically, in many database systems, index updates are independent from transactions. Okay? So the transaction goes and modifies some records. Okay? These records are not automatically updated in the index at the same time. Okay? The indexing runs periodically. Okay? So there may be some records that are modified, that those are kept separately. So if somebody else is accessing it, you will first look at the index and then you look at the unindexed records and say, is the result in there. So you will update the index not as each transaction executes, you will update it in batch mode slightly later. Okay? So what that means is you don't have to undo index updates. Okay? Although in that picture I showed the index was getting updated, typically in an implementation that doesn't do the same thing. So the advantage of this technique, first one, deadlock free. Okay, no deadlocks in the system. Clear? There are no locks, so there's nothing to deadlock. There is no lock. Okay, so there are no locks, so there will never be a deadlock. Okay? Maximum parallelism where achievable. Right? If there is really transactions are independent or accessing independent region, so suppose somebody is, let's say, the airline database. At any given time, you ask the question. So suppose you have locks per flight. You just ask the question, at any given time, what's the chance that two people are actually booking a seat on the same flight? Okay, it's more likely that the people are booking on different flights. If that is the case, I'll just let these transactions run. Okay? And if each transaction was accessing a different flight, there is no conflict. So all transactions will finish. Okay, but if you do detect a conflict, then you have to roll it back. Okay. So the disadvantage is the same thing, right? You have to rerun the transaction if it aborts, and that as the load increases, the probability of conflict also goes up. Okay, as the number of transactions that are operating in concurrently goes up, the probability that any two transactions actually access the same data item also goes up. Okay, if they access the same data item, there's a chance of conflict. So you'll just abort one of them, or in this case, abort both and rerun them. Okay, so You do have to rerun the transaction if it aborts. Yeah, that's the disadvantage of the system. The advantages are there's no locking over it. So this is a simple way of achieving concurrency control. Okay, you only check at the end. And the only check you do is when the transaction commits, you say, since I began, did any other transaction touch any record that I have touched? If the answer is yes, you just conservatively abort it. Okay, so that's that goes back to what check do you have to do. We just said, did any other transaction touch the records I have touched? If the answer is no, you will find a serializable schedule because they are all independent transactions. There are no dependency. If somebody touched it, then you'll say, I'll abort this transaction. Yes, question.
Why is it not
open? Okay, so I'll come to that in just one moment. Okay. So is this clear what concurrency control? So the last point is, why is it not used widely? Okay. So there has been a lot of research on optimistic concurrency control. But there is no commercial database that actually uses optimistic concurrency control. Okay. And this is simply because many databases are built with conservative assumptions. Okay. In other words, you want a database to make progress regardless of the load. Okay? The problem of optimistic concurrency control is when the load is high, a large number of transactions are going to abort. Okay? So you will basically oversaturate your CPU because all these transactions are running. Many of them will abort. They will rerun. Many of them will abort again and so on. So the actual progress in the system is going to slow down. So you don't want to sell some customer a database and the customer increases the load and the system basically just doesn't make progress because the load on the system will be high, but the number of transactions that are successfully finishing, which is the equivalent of good put, is very low. There may be a very small fraction of transactions commit successfully when the load is high. Okay? So you don't want that kind of behavior from your system. And as a result, commercial vendors try not to implement any optimistic concurrency control. You want the system to continue. It's better off blocking some transaction and increasing the latency rather than doing wasteful work. That's the philosophy behind commercial implementation, which is why you will not see this implemented, okay, in most databases. Okay. Any questions here? So now what next? I'm not going to do the next thing today, but I just want to mention. Now next what we'll do is pessimistic concurrency control. This was optimistic. They said, let everyone run and we'll figure out at the end if they did something bad. The next one says, we'll be very conservative. If there is any potential for a conflict, we won't even let that transaction start. We'll block it so that we will get some serializable order. Okay, so that we'll talk next time. Okay, so let's just stop here for today.